This is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is visual artist and writer, Ben Shattuck. And we're talking about his latest book, Six Walks in the Footsteps of Henry David Thoreau. Ben, welcome to the show. It is such a pleasure to talk to you about this book.
Thanks so much, Mark. It's a pleasure to be on the show.
Now, I cover a lot of nonfiction, mostly, as a matter of fact, on this show. But there are a few books where the writing really counts. It is, let me just tell you, it is such a relief to read a book like that. Because when you read a lot of things like physics and mathematics and biology, I'm interested in the subject matter, but the writing is pretty, you know, it just gets the point across. That's it. But this writing in this book is just outstanding, and we're going to have you read a little section of it. And to make the book even more fascinating, it is illustrated with your drawings. Talk to me about these drawings. Did you do any sketches along the way? Are these based on sketches from along the way?
I did a few sketches along the way, and I also took photographs and drew from those.
Got it.
You know, with drawing, I'm sure anybody can relate to this. It's like I will use every tool in my toolbox to get the drawing down on the page. The drawings were so fun to make. I think anybody who also straddles that, you know, writing and visual artwork line will probably say the same thing, and that is I run to the painting studio and I drag my feet to the writing desk.
Yes, I can identify with this.
Yes, such a joy to make drawings. And it is, I still get that like pit in my stomach from sixth grade having to write an essay when I sit down to start writing. Of course, the joy in writing comes when you're really trucking along and feel your ideas and the prose and everything working in concert to create a good passage. But yeah, writing is immediately gratifying. And, you know, I did take, and this might sound odd, but I did take visual notes along the way.
Okay.
Just marking, you know, a tree here, or, you know, you see those in some old 19th century works of sketches for painting. So I did take some notes and smaller sketches and sketchbooks, but yeah, I sort of used everything at my disposal.
This is an amazing book because it's about, and it takes place over years.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you end up following along in the tracks of Thoreau on six different walks, but there's a huge difference in the first part of the book and the second part of the book. The emotional difference between part one and part two is really striking. In part one, apparently you're getting over a disastrous love affair. Is that safe to say?
Yeah, breakup, yeah.
It's a big breakup. And then just to add a little bit of frosting on that cake, you get lime,
mm-hmm.
which is always fun. And everything seems like the Doors song, When You're Strange. I mean, it really, the darkness is palpable in those first couple of essays, and it's amazing the contrast with the second part.
Yeah.
Now,
yeah.
First of all, I'm in total shock that you hiked up Wachusett while you were on the meds from Lyme.
Yeah, I mean, you know, just a note on that first and second half. The book really, the seed of this book began in real emotional darkness, I had also on top of Lyme and living at my parents' house at the time at the coldest winter in Massachusetts in 100 years and the breakup and the painkiller meds. I had also chopped off the top half inch of my writing and painting hand finger.
It was a weird accident. It was while you were carrying a boat over a frozen lake.
Yeah, over frozen ground. You know, it's like, it really, I live in my, in the house where my great grandfather built this old house and then all these old sort of wooden boats. We live on the south coast of Massachusetts and it was in the middle of winter and I was moving a boat and my feet just, you know, one moment I was moving the boat standing up, and the next moment I had slipped on the ground and the boat came down on my hands, and I just stood up and looked at the top half inch of my finger in the snow. And
let's diverge right there for a minute, because one of the fascinating things that you do throughout the book is that something like that will happen to you, and you talk about, yes, it's just the tip of your finger, but it's part of your body, and it heals strangely. Like, you don't have the same feeling on it at all. But that leads you into discussion of what Thoreau thought of his body.
Yeah.
Like, what did Thoreau think about his body?
I forget the quote exactly, but it's something along the lines of, I love almost any other piece of nature more than my own body.
Wow.
You know, I don't think I think a lot of people, if you read Thoreau, the conspicuous absence in his writing is an interiority, I would say.
Yeah, yeah.
And you sort of, whenever you get those scraps, like, what did he think of his own body? What did he, I mean, one topic that comes up over and over is his sexuality. One topic that comes over and over, like, how did he, you know, he was a real champion of, he's an abolitionist, and he was trying to understand how he could live in a country that legalized human trafficking. And he was trying to understand how to live in a country that could prioritize industry over old growth forests, you know?
Yeah, but as he bring up in the book in a different section, then there was his whole, the way he wrote about Joe.
Yeah.
On the main trip.
Yeah.
Which was, as you described it, sometimes cruel and cold in his writing about people. I mean, here's this person who was involved in the abolitionist movement, yet he treated Joe like some kind of second-class citizen.
I think, you know, there's so many lessons in there. I think this question would, or this example, and let me just clarify a little bit. He was a great defender of, at least conceptually, of indigenous rights, indigenous land. In his writing, you'll find him being really, as you say, cruel of how he interacts with Joe, the Penobscot guide who he goes to Maine with. I don't have to say much in that passage. I just transcribe how Thoreau, you know, said, for instance, Joe would say something and his thoughts would be like a puff of smoke compared to the white man's sharpness. You know, it's there, it's really clear. And I think that's a great example of when people are trying to answer the question, should we hold people from the past accountable for their misdeeds or how they saw themselves within culture or saw their own privilege or saw their whatever it is. I think it's nice to chew on these questions and these examples because in some ways I wanted to throw like, yeah, he should have known better. And I do think he was sensitive enough and smart enough, and he had all the right ambition for moral clarity to scrub that of his writing, you know, those real insults to somebody who is Penobscot. I kind of expect better of him, and it just shows us how we can be blinded in our own prejudices, even when we say we might not stand for something. Well, how does the language look? How do your actions look? How does your interpersonal relationships bear out problematic cultural differences?
I find it fascinating, the contradictions, and I found myself as a reader appreciating the fact that you brought out those contradictions, that you sort of get a fuller realistic picture of Thoreau. And the other thing that you brought up is your ideas about him and his writing changed dramatically throughout the course of your life.
Mm-hmm.
That when you were a high school student, I love this, you found him boring, misanthropic writer who lived before his mother and grew beans. And this phrase amazes me, as if he were Aristotle. That was one of my favorite lines in the book. Explain yourself, kid. Grow beans like you were Aristotle?
Well, that is, I think that is an example of trying to use prose in the voice of my thinking at the time, where it's like I felt annoyed that I had to read him in high school. I felt like he was homework. I felt like I don't understand why this writer is so important. And then, I mean, there are some writers who you just need to grow up.
That's right.
To love.
That's right.
Really think no high school student should read Walden or Civil Disobedience. I do think they should read Thoreau, and I think they should go straight to his journals, because in those journals, and this is how, when I was recovering from my hand injury, I picked up his selected journals, 1837 to 61, and started just picking pages at random and read the most beautiful lines.
Yep, yep.
I couldn't get over how, I didn't understand how I had missed him, and I think that.
I think that's true of an awful lot of writing. I think we ruin a lot of authors for people when we assign them as homework in high school and junior high school.
Yeah, that's right.
I think there are books I will never go back and read because of my experience of them in junior high school, yet I'm sure they're actually really decent books.
Yeah, right. I mean, I think with Thoreau, I don't know, it's still hard to read some of the, I've read hundreds and hundreds of pages of Thoreau by now, and I somehow find myself knowing a lot more about Thoreau than I would have ever thought. But his writing, especially his journals, is undeniably beautiful. Everything from the famous line, the bluebird carries a sky on its back, to the subtler lines, like, he woke up one July morning and the first line he wrote was, the sound of the crickets in the morning is the sound of the earth still dreaming. And it's like, who?
I know.
When I read these lines, it's like, who is this? What, like, why spend so much time looking so closely at nature and transcribing his own feelings about it with such eloquence? I came to realize, especially when I read that he died at 44, which is such a young age, I realized, this is just a poetic, searching, intelligent young man at the peak of his physical abilities. He's curious. He doesn't like the country that he lives in, trying to comprehend the world. And all of a sudden, Thoreau went from this stone monolith of American arts and letters to sort of a wild growth in my mind. Yeah. I just thought, wow, he's actually like a wild man.
And you were mistaken for a reenactment of Thoreau.
Yeah.
I think that's sort of perfect.
Yeah. I could actually read that passage later if you'd like, but.
Do you want to do it now? That was just wild.
Yeah, it's every writer / biographer's dream to actually be mistaken. But here it is. So the book is split into six walks and four interludes. So this is what I call interludes. It's not necessarily one of his walks, but they're sort of thought pieces on what I have been doing. So this one is called Walden Pond. I'd never visited Walden Pond. So on a hot day in August, a couple months after hiking Mount Katahdin, I drove up to see the most famous pond in America. A replica of Henry's cabin near the parking lot was smaller than I expected, and it took some imagination to believe that the site was once tranquil, now with the sound of nearby traffic and families heading to the pond. I walked into the cabin, sat in a replica rocking chair beside a replica wood stove. I admit I was probably hollow-eyed and staring at nothing or at the floor. Those were the days of antibiotics and Lyme disease, which had only worsened since the first walks. I had a beard then, too, and long hair because I'd given up shaving or getting haircuts under the dulling effects that bad health has on grooming. still. I was surprised when a woman and her little son walked through the door, stopped, and she said to her boy, "Oh, look, there he is." I've always dressed traditionally, I suppose. Most of my pants are black cotton and my shirts are button-downs. I wear boots or clogs. "Ask him a question," she said to the boy, pushing him forward toward the thorough reenactor she thought I was. I considered if I should try to draw up a line about growing beans or civil disobedience for the little boy, who is now walking very hesitantly across the creaking wooden floor. But my mind was so tired then, I just held up a hand. "No," I said, smiling. I stood, patted down my pants nervously. I skirted past the boy and strode out of the cabin toward the pond where Henry had gone skinny dipping most mornings. The pond was cerulean cellophane, and the trees around its rim swayed in the midsummer wind. I sat in the sand watching swallows picking at the surface, drinking, and then trying to snatch up a white feather boating across. To my side, an elderly man in a bathing suit was using a walker to make his way toward the water. He was alone, and he moved slowly, and it looked painfully. He took a few steps, to few seconds to pause after each step. He then lift his walker, move it half a foot forward, step, lift his walker, move it forward and step. There are some things you know you'll never see again, like a man shuffling into a pond with a walker, the waterline inching up to his tight grip on the handles. And then he fell back into the lap of water. It was as close to watching somebody fly as I'll see. He stretched flat, his arms winged out, his toes surfaced, and above him the swallows kept swooping. His arms lifted overhead, and he backpedaled toward the center of Walden Pond, moving much more swiftly than he had when gravity was holding him. He left the walker there, and I wrote in my journal the words husk and shed. I took off my shirt, my shoes, socks, pants, down to my boxers, and then I walked into the water, past the man's walker. Little khaki-colored fish, the size of alewives I'd seen in Wellfleet, were weaving around the walker's legs. I swam out to where the bottom was 10 or 15 feet below. I admired how clear the pond was. I held my breath, let it out, sank, and the air bubbles licked up my face. I opened my eyes to see blurry shafts of sunlight skewering the water overhead. My lungs burned, but it felt good because the deeper I went, the less my lime-pinched joints hurt. My feet touched the bottom. I stood there, my ears pressured, my joints relieved, in the pond where Henry went every morning. How quiet it was down there on the floor of Walden Pond. Thank you.
That's a great example of why you need to read this book. You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is visual artist and writer Ben Shattuck, and we are talking about his latest book. I strongly recommend it, Six Walks in the Footsteps of Henry David Thoreau. At several points throughout the book, you'll be someplace, whether you're on the top of a mountain or you're on the beach, and it just typical human behavior really drives you around the bend. And you're not as obvious as I am being about it, but I think you're on Katahdin, or where the girl, the teenage girl, just had this
Katahdin.
This meltdown.
Yes.
Or and there was some guy complaining about not being able to get phone service.
Yeah.
It seems funny in retrospect, but it's so interesting. And this happens to me every once in a while too, that if you're outside, and, you know, you're just trying to be quiet and enjoy where you are, then, like, a weird aspect of humanity intrudes, and it throws everything into high relief. And you have several of those experiences in this book.
Yeah. Well, yes, there are, especially on top of Mount Katahdin. That was, I noticed, the widest chasm between Thoreau's experience and my experience. I mean, when Thoreau went on, he never even summited, and he invokes the gods a lot in his writing about Katahdin. You know, there's a swirl of clouds and rain and thunder, and there's nobody around. It's so remote that at one point he thought he saw another group's footprints when they're going down Catan that turned out to be his own footprint from going up. So there's just nobody there. That's much different from going to Millinocket, making a reservation or the parking lot at the base of Catan and walking up. As if Thoreau writes about the gods on top of Catan, and the gods have long left, and, you know, there is, when you look at the top and see three people on FaceTime with their families back at home.
That's what it brought up for me, was Thoreau's experiences now, that aspect of them, of alone in some kind of habitat or of an environment, are so tough to find nowadays.
Well, I would say sometimes, but I would say that why Thoreau is so, what I found, why Thoreau is so relevant today is not because of some concept of environmentalism or some like abstract example of nature writing, but if you actually sit down and read a lot of his work, you'll start to notice some like really peculiar tendency of his, and that is, his nature is not the Rocky Mountains, it's not John Muir, it's not the Great Plains. His nature is so small. He's a master of scale. It is about 1 foot by 1 foot. It's a butterfly landing on milkweed. It's, you know, how frost edges a leaf that's just fallen in November. It's a lot of what we still find here. We might not have those sweeping views and solitude, but I would say you can get 90% of what Thoreau is looking at by just zooming in. I mean, if you really take a Thoreauvian lens to nature, you can have experiences like his a mile outside of Boston. I mean, it's not restricted to a wilderness that we might sort of fantasize about. I mean, Thoreau often talks about how frustrated he is with all the farmers around Concord, because as everybody who's been in woods in New England see, you see all these stone walls running through the forest. The forests were clear cut, and a lot of nature was disappearing when Thoreau, by the mid 19th century. So I think there's a lot of relevance and a lot of similarities in his experiences and our experiences. And you don't need to fly to, you know, Glacier National Park to experience the nature that Thoreau's talking about.
And if you do, there'll still be people checking if they can get...
Yeah, exactly. You know, I have gotten this question a few times at book readings, and I do think where, if the nature is still there, if there are, you know, high bush blueberries blooming and... there are tides moving in and out of salt marshes, and there are bubbles caught in the ice, and everything that Thoreau describes, we still have that. Like, what is the difference? And I think the difference is how we interact with nature, how, you know, when people say, what can we do to connect more to Thoreau's experience, it's like, leave your cell phone at home. Don't take a cell. You know,
yes.
Don't use nature as an Instagram background. try to approach nature as a stranger and something to behold, rather than something to use for your own.
Is part of the difference in Thoreau's and our experiences of the natural world quiet?
Yeah.
I mean, you're right. Nature is there everywhere, and I have literally spent more than an hour looking at a stand of goldenrod, and look at all the different bugs and insects that are in that. But one of the things that's tough to find is the non-intrusion, something away from the din of day-to-day life. There's just so many of us now.
There are so many of us. Yeah, I was trying to. When I was taking these walks, I was trying to sometimes think, what is really different? What is undeniably different? You know, cars, you just wherever you can hear the sound of traffic from wherever you are. If you have a cell phone, then you feel connected to the world in a way that is harder to it's harder to have a sincere experience in nature if you're connected to the as Thoreau said, the village. And then also like night skies. I can't imagine sort of like a beautiful swirling Milky Way that somebody in the mid 19th century saw compared to what you might see in Concord today. There are a few things in there that are undeniably different and sad.
While you're speaking about night, both in your visual art and in this book, darkness and night figure prominently. And a lot of your drawings are very dark. And I don't mean that emotionally dark. I mean, they're dark. But also at night, there are all sorts of things that you write about in the book. What's the appeal of night to you?
I've recently thought maybe one of my favorite views on this planet is looking either, you know, from one hillside to another or across the water and seeing a light in a window, you know, just a little blinking light. There's something about looking across a distance and seeing a small glowing light. It just has so much emotion, and all the subdued shapes and colors that are between that light and you. I was recently wondering the same thing. Like, what is it about night and the darkness of these drawings and paintings that I make? And I live in my great-grandfather's old house, and there's a big bay that separates the house, and far across are a couple lights and also a lighthouse. And I wonder if, you know, as I was a kid, maybe I was looking out at those, and there's just some remnants of that visual appeal from childhood there. But I also, I mean, in terms of with the paintings, which I don't have a book, I just have drawings, anybody who paints representationally, and especially still lives, will know what I'm talking about, that there is like, there's something about how shadows play with a still image and a reveal of a shape that is so
magical,
right?
Exactly. Ben, we've run out of time, and we're going to continue that conversation because we're going to talk about your artwork and another interview, which I'm really looking forward to. My guest tonight is visual artist and writer Ben Chaddock. And we've been talking about his latest book. It's just a great read. Six Walks in the Footsteps of Henry David Thoreau. It even includes a section about alien encounters. And I'm just not going to say any more than that. Ben, it's been a pleasure.
Mark, it's been so fun talking. Thanks for having me on.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.